Capitalism, The Unknown Ideal, by Ayn Rand, concluded. Disc 12. He is not to judge, not to question, not to condemn, only to love. To love without cause, indiscriminately, unconditionally, in violation of any values, standards, or convictions of his own. The only valuable assistance that Western men could, in fact, offer to undeveloped countries is to enlighten them on the nature of capitalism and help them to establish it. But this would clash with the natives' cultural traditions. Industrialization cannot be grafted onto superstitious irrationality. The choice is either or. Besides, it is a knowledge which the West itself has lost, and it is the specific element which the encyclical damns. While the encyclical demands a kind of unfastidious relativism in regard to cultural values and stressedly urges respect for the right of primitive cultures to hold any values whatever, it does not extend this tolerance to Western civilization. Speaking of Western businessmen who deal with countries recently opened to industrialization, the encyclical states, "Why then do they return to the inhuman principles of individualism when they operate in less developed countries?" 70. Observe that the horrors of tribal existence in those undeveloped countries evoke no condemnation from the encyclical, only individualism. The principle that raised mankind out of the primordial swamps is branded as inhuman. In the light of that statement, observe the encyclical's contempt for conceptual integrity when it advocates the construction of a better world, one which shows deeper respect for the rights and the vocation of the individual. 65. What are the rights of the individual in a world that regards individualism as inhuman? No answer. There is another remark pertaining to Western nations which is worth noting. The encyclical states, "We are pleased to learn that in certain nations, military service can be partially accomplished by doing social service, a service pure and simple." 74. It is interesting to discover the probable source of the notion of substituting social work for military service, of the claim that American youths owe their country some years of servitude, pure and simple, a vicious notion, more evil than the draft, a singularly un-American notion in that it contradicts every fundamental principle of the United States. The philosophy that created the United States is the encyclical's target, the enemy it seeks to obliterate. A casual reference that seems aimed at Latin America is a bit of window dressing, a booby trap for compromisers, upon which they did pounce eagerly. That reference states, "If certain landed estates impede the general prosperity because they are extensive, unused, or poorly used, the common good sometimes demands their expropriation." 24. But whatever the sins of Latin America, capitalism is not one of them. Capitalism, a system based on the recognition and protection of individual rights, has never existed in Latin America. In the past and at present, Latin America was and is ruled by a primitive form of fascism, an unorganized, unstructured rule by coup d'etat, by militaristic gangs, i.e. by physical force, which tolerates a nominal pretense at private property, subject to expropriation by any gang in power, which is the cause of Latin America's economic stagnation. The encyclical is concerned with help to the undeveloped nations of the world. Latin America is high on the list of the undeveloped. It is unable to feed its own people. Can anyone imagine Latin America in the role of global provider, supplying the needs of the entire world? It is only the United States, the country created by the principles of individualism, the freest example of capitalism in history, the first and last exponent of the rights of man, that could attempt such a role, and would thereby be induced to commit suicide. Now observe that the encyclical is not concerned with man, with the individual. The unit of its thinking is the tribe, nations, countries, peoples. And it discusses them as if they had a totalitarian power to dispose of their citizens, as if such entities as individuals were of no significance any longer. This is indicative of the encyclical strategy. The United States is the highest achievement of the millennia of Western civilization's struggle toward individualism, and its last precarious remnant. With the obliteration of the United States, i.e. of capitalism, there will be nothing left to deal with on the face of the globe but collectivized tribes. To hasten that day, the encyclical treats it as a fait accompli and addresses itself to the relationships among tribes. Observe that the same morality, altruism, the morality of self-immolation, which for centuries has been preached against the individual, is now preached against the civilized nations. The creed of self-sacrifice, the primordial weapon used to penalize man's success on earth, to undercut his self-confidence, to cripple his independence, to poison his enjoyment of life, to emasculate his pride, to stunt his self-esteem and paralyze his mind, is now counted upon to wreak the same destruction on civilized nations and on civilization as such. I quote John Galt, "You have reached the blind alley of the treason you committed when you agreed that you had no right to exist. Once you believed it was only a compromise, you conceded it was evil to live for yourself, but moral to live for the sake of your children. Then you conceded that it was selfish to live for your children, but moral to live for your community. Then you conceded that it was selfish to live for your community, but moral to live for your country. Now, you are letting this greatest of countries be devoured by any scum from any corner of the earth, while you concede that it is selfish to live for your country, and that your moral duty is to live for the globe. A man who has no right to life has no right to values and will not keep them." Atlas shrugged. Rights are conditions of existence required by man's nature for his proper survival, qua man, i.e. qua rational being. They are not compatible with altruism. Man's soul or spirit is his consciousness. The motor of his consciousness is reason. Deprive him of freedom, i.e. of the right to use his mind, and what is left of him is only a physical body, ready to be manipulated by the strings of any tribe. Ask yourself whether you have ever read a document as body-oriented as that encyclical. The inhabitants of the world it proposes to establish are robots tuned to respond to a single stimulus, need. The lowest, grossest, physicalistic need of any other robots anywhere. The minimum necessities, the barely sufficient to keep all robots in working order, eating, sleeping, eliminating, and procreating, to produce more robots to work, eat, sleep, eliminate, and procreate. The most dehumanizing level of poverty is the level on which bare animal necessities become one's only concern and goal. This is the level which the encyclical proposes to institutionalize, and on which it proposes to immobilize all of mankind forever, with the animal needs of all as the only motivation of all. All other rights whatsoever are to be subordinated to this principle. If the encyclical charges that in a capitalist society men fall victim to a stifling materialism, what is the atmosphere of that proposed world? The survivor of one such plan described it as follows. "We had no way of knowing their ability, the ability of others. We had no way of controlling their needs. All we knew was that we were beasts of burden, struggling blindly in some sort of place that was half hospital, half stockyards, a place geared to nothing but disability, disaster, disease. Beasts put there for the relief of whatever whoever chose to say was whichever's need. To work with no chance for an extra ration till the Cambodians have been fed and the Patagonians have been sent through college. To work on a blank check held by every creature born, by men whom you'll never see, whose needs you'll never know, whose ability or laziness or sloppiness or fraud you have no way to learn and no right to question, just to work and work and work, and leave it up to the Ivies and the Geralds of the world to decide whose stomach will consume the efforts, the dreams, and the days of your life." Atlas shrugged. "Do you think that I was exaggerating, and that no one preaches ideals of that kind? But, you say, the encyclical's ideal will not work. It is not intended to work." It is not intended to relieve suffering or to abolish poverty. It is intended to induce guilt. It is not intended to be accepted and practiced. It is intended to be accepted and broken, broken by man's selfish desire to live, which will thus be turned into a shameful weakness. Men who accept as an ideal an irrational goal which they cannot achieve never lift their heads thereafter, and never discover that their bowed heads were the only goal to be achieved. The relief of suffering is not altruism's motive. It is only its rationalization. Self-sacrifice is not altruism's means to a happier end, it is its end. Self-sacrifice as man's permanent state, as a way of life and joyless toil, in the muck of a desolate earth where no why is ever to flash on in the veiled, extinguished eyes of children. The encyclical comes close to admitting this prospect and does not attempt to offer any earthly justification for altruistic martyrdom. It declares, "Far from being the ultimate measure of all things, man can only realize himself by reaching beyond himself." 42. Beyond the grave? And, "This road toward a greater humanity requires effort and sacrifice, but suffering itself, accepted for the love of our brethren, favors the progress of the entire human family." 79. And, "We are all united in this progress toward God." 80. As to the attitude toward man's mind, the clearest admission is to be found outside the encyclical. In a speech to a national conference of Italian bishops on April 7, 1967, Pope Paul VI denounced the questioning of any dogma that does not please and that demands the humble homage of the mind to be received, and he urged the bishops to combat the cult of one's own person. The New York Times, April 8, 1967. On the question of what political system it advocates, the encyclical is scornfully indifferent. It would apparently find any political system acceptable, provided it is a version of statism. The vague allusions to some nominal form of private property make it probable that the encyclical favors fascism. On the other hand, the tone, style, and vulgarity of argumentation suggest a shopworn Marxism. But this very vulgarity seems to indicate a profound indifference to intellectual discourse. As if contemptuous of its audience, the encyclical picked whatever clichés were deemed to be safely fashionable today. The encyclical insists emphatically on only two political demands: that the nations of the future embrace statism, with a totalitarian control of their citizens' economic activities, and that these nations unite into a global state with a totalitarian power over global planning. This international collaboration on a worldwide scale requires institutions that will prepare, coordinate, and direct it. Who does not see the necessity of thus establishing progressively a world authority capable of acting effectively in the juridical and political sectors? 78. Is there any difference between the encyclical's philosophy and communism? I am perfectly willing on this matter to take the word of an eminent Catholic authority. Under the headline "Encyclical Termed Rebuff to Marxism," the New York Times of March 31, 1967 reports, "The Reverend John Courtney Murray, the prominent Jesuit theologian, described Pope Paul's newest encyclical yesterday as the Church's definitive answer to Marxism. The Marxists have proposed one way, and in pursuing their program they rely on man alone," Father Murray said. "Now Pope Paul VI has issued a detailed plan to accomplish the same goal on the basis of true humanism, humanism that recognizes man's religious nature." Amen. So much for those American conservatives who claim that religion is the base of capitalism, and who believe that they can have capitalism and eat it too, as the moral cannibalism of the altruist ethics demands. And so much for those modern liberals who pride themselves on being the champions of reason, science, and progress, and who smear the advocates of capitalism as superstitious reactionary representatives of a dark past. Move over, comrades, and make room for your latest fellow travelers, who had always belonged on your side. Then take a look, if you dare, at the kind of past they represent. This is the spectacle of religion climbing on the bandwagon of statism, in a desperate attempt to recapture the power it lost at the time of the Renaissance. The Catholic Church has never given up the hope to re-establish the medieval union of church and state, with a global state and a global theocracy as its ultimate goal. Since the Renaissance, it has always been cautiously last to join that political movement which could serve its purpose at the time. This time it is too late. Collectivism is dead intellectually. The bandwagon on which the Church has climbed is a hearse. But counting on that vehicle, the Catholic Church is deserting Western civilization and calling upon the barbarian hordes to devour the achievements of man's mind. There is an element of sadness in this spectacle. Catholicism had once been the most philosophical of all religions. Its long, illustrious philosophical history was illuminated by a giant, Thomas Aquinas. He brought an Aristotelian view of reason, an Aristotelian epistemology, back into European culture, and lighted the way to the Renaissance. For the brief span of the 19th century, when his was the dominant influence among Catholic philosophers, the grandeur of his thought almost lifted the Church close to the realm of reason, though at the price of a basic contradiction. Now we are witnessing the end of the Aquinas line, with the Church turning again to his primordial antagonist, who fits it better, to the mind-hating, life-hating St. Augustine. One could only wish they had given St. Thomas a more dignified requiem. The encyclical is the voice of the Dark Ages rising again in today's intellectual vacuum, like a cold wind whistling through the empty streets of an abandoned civilization. Unable to resolve a lethal contradiction, the conflict between individualism and altruism, the West is giving up. When men give up reason and freedom, the vacuum is filled by faith and force. No social system can stand for long without a moral base. Project a magnificent skyscraper being built on quicksands, while men are struggling upward to add the 100th and 200th stories, the 10th and 20th are vanishing, sucked under by the muck. That is the history of capitalism, of its swaying, tottering attempt to stand erect on the foundation of the altruist morality. It's either or. If capitalism's befuddled, guilt-ridden apologists do not know it, two fully consistent representatives of altruism do know it, Catholicism and Communism. Their rapprochement, therefore, is not astonishing. Their differences pertain only to the supernatural, but here in reality on earth they have three cardinal elements in common: the same morality, altruism, the same goal, global rule by force, the same enemy, man's mind. There is a precedent for their strategy. In the German election of 1933, the communists supported the Nazis, on the premise that they could fight each other for power later, but must first destroy their common enemy, capitalism. Today, Catholicism and communism may well cooperate on the premise that they will fight each other for power later, but must first destroy their common enemy, the individual, by forcing mankind to unite to form one neck, ready for one leash. The encyclical was endorsed with enthusiasm by the communist press the world over. The French Communist Party newspaper L'Humanité said the encyclical was often moving and constructive for highlighting the evils of capitalism, long emphasized by Marxists, reports the New York Times, March 30, 1967. Those who do not understand the role of moral self-confidence in human affairs will not appreciate the sardonically ludicrous quality of the following item from the same report. The French communists, however, deplored the failure of the Pope to make a distinction between rich communist countries and rich capitalist countries in his general strictures against imbalance between the have and have-not nations. Thus, wealth acquired by force is rightful property, but wealth earned by production is not. Looting is moral, but producing is not. And while the looter's spokesmen object to the encyclical's damnation of wealth, the producer's spokesmen crawl, evading the issues, accepting the insults, promising to give their wealth away. If capitalism does not survive, this is the spectacle that will have made it unworthy of survival. The New York Times, March 30, 1967, declared editorially that the encyclical is remarkably advanced in its economic philosophy. It is sophisticated, comprehensive, and penetrating. If by advanced, the editorial meant that the encyclical's philosophy has caught up with that of modern liberals, one would have to agree, except that the Times is mistaken about the direction of the motion involved. It is not that the encyclical has progressed to the 20th century. It is that the liberals have reverted to the fourth. The Wall Street Journal, May 10, 1967, went further. It declared, in effect, that the Pope didn't mean it. The encyclical, it alleged, was just a misunderstanding caused by some mysterious conspiracy of the Vatican translators who misinterpreted the Pope's ideas in transferring them from the original Latin into English. His Holiness may not be showering compliments on the free market system, but he is not at all saying what the Vatican's English version appeared to make him say. Through minute comparisons of Latin paragraphs with their official and unofficial translations and columns of casuistic hair-splitting, the Wall Street Journal reached the conclusion that it was not capitalism that the Pope was denouncing, but only some opinions of capitalism. Which opinions? According to the unofficial translation, the encyclical's paragraph 26 reads as follows. But out of these new conditions, we know not how, some opinions have crept into human society, according to which profit was regarded, in these opinions, as the foremost incentive to encourage economic progress, free competition as the supreme rule of economics, private ownership of the means of production as an absolute right, which would accept neither limits nor a social duty related to it. In the Latin, said the article, Pope Paul is acknowledging the hardships in the development of some kinds of capitalism. But he puts the blame for that not on the whole woeful system, i.e. the whole capitalistic system, but on some corrupt views of it. If the views advocating the profit motive, free competition, and private property were corrupt, just what is capitalism? Blank out. What is the Wall Street Journal's definition of capitalism? Blank out. What are we to designate as capitalism once all of its essential characteristics are removed? Blank out. This last question indicates the unstated meaning of that article. Since the Pope does not attack capitalism, but only its fundamental principles, we don't have to worry. And for what do you suppose did that article find courage to reproach the encyclical? What might have been wished for in the encyclical was an acknowledgement that capitalism can accept, and in the United States as well as other places does accept, a great many social responsibilities. Sic transit gloria vi wall. A similar attitude, with a similar range of vision, is taken by Time magazine, April 7, 1967. Although Pope Paul had probably tried to give a Christian message relevant to the world's contemporary economic situation, his encyclical virtually ignored the fact that old-style laissez-faire capitalism is about as dead as Das Kapital. Quite clearly, the Pope's condemnation of capitalism was addressed to the unreconstructed variety that persists, for example, in Latin America. If this were a competition, the prize would go to Fortune, the businessmen's magazine, May 1967. Its attitude is aggressively amoral and aphilosophical. It is proudly determined to maintain the separation of economics and ethics. Capitalism is only an economic system, it says. First acknowledging the Pope's praiseworthy purpose, Fortune declares, But despite its modern and global vision, Populorum Progressio may be a self-defeating document. It takes a dated and suspicious view of the workings of economic enterprise. The Pope has set up a straw man that has few defenders. If this passage, paragraph 26, is taken literally, unalloyed laissez-faire in fact governs no significant part of the world's commerce. Ownership in advanced countries has evolved in a way that subsumes social obligations. Absolute private rights are irrelevant in advanced industrial societies. After conceding all that, Fortune seems to be astonished and hurt that the Pope did not find it necessary to include businessmen among the men of goodwill whom he calls upon to combat global poverty. In omitting any specific reference to the businessman, he slights a natural and necessary ally, who indeed is already deeply committed in many parts of the world to the kind of effort that Paul urges. Perhaps the businessman is taken for granted as a kind of primordial force that can be counted upon to provide motive power, and that needs only to be tamed and harnessed and carefully watched. And isn't that Fortune's own view of businessmen in their unalloyed state? The Vatican has seldom seemed able to look at capitalism as other than a necessary evil at best, and Populorum Progressio suggests that a better understanding still comes hard. This is not to suggest that capitalism is a complete formula for social enlightenment and progress. It is only an economic system that men of goodwill can use, more successfully than any other system yet conceived, to attain the social goals that politics and religion help to define. Observe the indecency of trying to justify capitalism on the grounds of altruistic service. Observe also the naivete of the cynical. It is not their wealth, nor their relief of poverty, that the encyclical is after. Militantly concrete-bound, equating cynicism with practicality, modern pragmatists are unable to see beyond the range of the moment, or to grasp what moves the world and determines its direction. Men who are willing to swim with any current, to compromise on anything, to serve as means to anyone's ends, lose the ability to understand the power of ideas. And while two hordes of man-haters who do understand it are converging on civilization, they sit in the middle, declaring that principles are straw men. I have heard the same accusation directed at objectivism. We are fighting a straw man, they say. Nobody preaches the kind of ideas we are opposing. Well, as a friend of mine observed, only the Vatican, the Kremlin, and the Empire State Building know the real issues of the modern world. Appendix: Man's Rights by Ayn Rand. If one wishes to advocate a free society, that is, capitalism, one must realize that its indispensable foundation is the principle of individual rights. If one wishes to uphold individual rights, one must realize that capitalism is the only system that can uphold and protect them. And if one wishes to gauge the relationship of freedom to the goals of today's intellectuals, one may gauge it by the fact that the concept of individual rights is evaded, distorted, perverted, and seldom discussed, most conspicuously seldom, by the so-called conservatives. Rights are a moral concept, the concept that provides a logical transition from the principles guiding an individual's actions to the principles guiding his relationship with others, the concept that preserves and protects individual morality in a social context, the link between the moral code of a man and the legal code of a society, between ethics and politics. Individual rights are the means of subordinating society to moral law. Every political system is based on some code of ethics. The dominant ethics of mankind's history were variants of the altruist collectivist doctrine, which subordinated the individual to some higher authority, either mystical or social. Consequently, most political systems were variants of the same statist tyranny, differing only in degree, not in basic principle, limited only by the accidents of tradition, of chaos, of bloody strife and periodic collapse. Under all such systems, morality was a code applicable to the individual, but not to society. Society was placed outside the moral law, as its embodiment or source or exclusive interpreter, and the inculcation of self-sacrificial devotion to social duty was regarded as the main purpose of ethics in man's earthly existence. Since there is no such entity as society, since society is only a number of individual men, this meant in practice that the rulers of society were exempt from moral law. Subject only to traditional rituals, they held total power and exacted blind obedience on the implicit principle of the good is that which is good for society, or for the tribe, the race, the nation, and the ruler's edicts are its voice on earth. This was true of all statist systems, under all variants of the altruist collectivist ethics, mystical or social. The divine right of kings summarizes the political theory of the first, vox populi, vox dei, of the second. As witness, the theocracy of Egypt, with the pharaoh as an embodied god, the unlimited majority rule or democracy of Athens, the welfare state run by the emperors of Rome, the Inquisition of the late Middle Ages, The absolute monarchy of France, the welfare state of Bismarck's Prussia, the gas chambers of Nazi Germany, the slaughterhouse of the Soviet Union. All these political systems were expressions of the altruist collectivist ethics. And their common characteristic is the fact that society stood above the moral law as an omnipotent sovereign whim worshipper. Thus, politically, all these systems were variants of an amoral society. The most profoundly revolutionary achievement of the United States of America was the subordination of society to moral law. The principle of man's individual rights represented the extension of morality into the social system, as a limitation on the power of the state, as man's protection against the brute force of the collective, as the subordination of might to right. The United States was the first moral society in history. All previous systems had regarded man as a sacrificial means to the ends of others, and society as an end in itself. The United States regarded man as an end in himself, and society as a means to the peaceful, orderly, voluntary coexistence of individuals. All previous systems had held that man's life belongs to society, that society can dispose of him in any way it pleases, and that any freedom he enjoys is his only by favor, by the permission of society, which may be revoked at any time. The United States held that man's life is his by right, which means by moral principle and by his nature, that a right is the property of an individual, that society as such has no rights, and that the only moral purpose of a government is the protection of individual rights. A right is a moral principle defining and sanctioning a man's freedom of action in a social context. There is only one fundamental right, all the others are its consequences or corollaries, a man's right to his own life. Life is a process of self-sustaining and self-generated action. The right to life means the right to engage in self-sustaining and self-generated action, which means the freedom to take all the actions required by the nature of a rational being for the support, the furtherance, the fulfillment, and the enjoyment of his own life. Such is the meaning of the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The concept of a right pertains only to action, specifically to freedom of action. It means freedom from physical compulsion, coercion, or interference by other men. Thus, for every individual, a right is the moral sanction of a positive, of his freedom to act on his own judgment, for his own goals, by his own voluntary, uncoerced choice. As to his neighbors, his rights impose no obligations on them except of a negative kind, to abstain from violating his rights. The right to life is the source of all rights, and the right to property is their only implementation. Without property rights, no other rights are possible. Since man has to sustain his life by his own effort, the man who has no right to the product of his effort has no means to sustain his life. The man who produces while others dispose of his product is a slave. Bear in mind that the right to property is a right to action like all the others. It is not the right to an object, but to the action and the consequences of producing or earning that object. It is not a guarantee that a man will earn any property, but only a guarantee that he will own it if he earns it. It is the right to gain, to keep, to use, and to dispose of material values. The concept of individual rights is so new in human history that most men have not grasped it fully to this day. In accordance with the two theories of ethics, the mystical or the social, some men assert that rights are a gift of God, others that rights are a gift of society, but in fact, the source of rights is man's nature. The Declaration of Independence stated that men are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. Whether one believes that man is the product of a creator or of nature, the issue of man's origin does not alter the fact that he is an entity of a specific kind, a rational being, that he cannot function successfully under coercion, and that rights are a necessary condition of his particular mode of survival. The source of man's rights is not divine law or congressional law, but the law of identity. A is A and man is man. Rights are conditions of existence required by man's nature for his proper survival. If man is to live on earth, it is right for him to use his mind. It is right to act on his own free judgment. It is right to work for his values and to keep the product of his work. If life on earth is his purpose, he has a right to live as a rational being. Nature forbids him the irrational. Atlas shrugged. To violate man's rights means to compel him to act against his own judgment, or to expropriate his values. Basically, there is only one way to do it, by the use of physical force. There are two potential violators of man's rights, the criminals and the government. The great achievement of the United States was to draw a distinction between these two by forbidding to the second the legalized version of the activities of the first. The Declaration of Independence laid down the principle that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men. This provided the only valid justification of a government and defined its only proper purpose, to protect man's rights by protecting him from physical violence. Thus, the government's function was changed from the role of ruler to the role of servant. The government was set to protect man from criminals, and the Constitution was written to protect man from the government. The Bill of Rights was not directed against private citizens, but against the government, as an explicit declaration that individual rights supersede any public or social power. The result was the pattern of a civilized society which, for the brief span of some 150 years, America came close to achieving. A civilized society is one in which physical force is banned from human relationships, in which the government, acting as a policeman, may use force only in retaliation and only against those who initiate its use. This was the essential meaning and intent of America's political philosophy, implicit in the principle of individual rights. But it was not formulated explicitly, nor fully accepted, nor consistently practiced. America's inner contradiction was the altruist-collectivist ethics. Altruism is incompatible with freedom, with capitalism, and with individual rights. One cannot combine the pursuit of happiness with the moral status of a sacrificial animal. It was the concept of individual rights that had given birth to a free society. It was with the destruction of individual rights that the destruction of freedom had to begin. A collectivist tyranny dare not enslave a country by an outright confiscation of its values, material or moral. It has to be done by a process of internal corruption. Just as in the material realm, the plundering of a country's wealth is accomplished by inflating the currency, so today one may witness the process of inflation being applied to the realm of rights. The process entails such a growth of newly promulgated rights that people do not notice the fact that the meaning of the concept is being reversed. Just as bad money drives out good money, so these printing press rights negate authentic rights. Consider the curious fact that never has there been such a proliferation all over the world of two contradictory phenomena, of alleged new rights and of slave labor camps. The gimmick was the switch of the concept of rights from the political to the economic realm. The Democratic Party platform of 1960 summarizes the switch boldly and explicitly. It declares that a Democratic administration will reaffirm the economic Bill of Rights which Franklin Roosevelt wrote into our national conscience 16 years ago. Bear clearly in mind the meaning of the concept of rights when you read the list which that platform offers. 1. The right to a useful and remunerative job in the industries or shops or farms or mines of the nation. 2. The right to earn enough to provide adequate food and clothing and recreation. 3. The right of every farmer to raise and sell his products at a return which will give him and his family a decent living. 4. The right of every businessman, large and small, to trade in an atmosphere of freedom from unfair competition and domination by monopolies at home and abroad. 5. The right of every family to a decent home. 6. The right to adequate medical care and the opportunity to achieve and enjoy good health. 7. The right to adequate protection from the economic fears of old age, sickness, accidents, and unemployment. 8. The right to a good education. A single question added to each of the above 8 clauses would make the issue clear. At whose expense? Jobs, food, clothing, recreation, homes, medical care, education, etc. do not grow in nature. These are man-made values. Goods and services produced by men, who is to provide them? If some men are entitled by right to the products of the work of others, it means that those others are deprived of rights and condemned to slave labor. Any alleged right of one man which necessitates the violation of the rights of another is not and cannot be a right. No man can have a right to impose an unchosen obligation, an unrewarded duty, or an involuntary servitude on another man. There can be no such thing as the right to enslave. A right does not include the material implementation of that right by other men. It includes only the freedom to earn that implementation by one's own effort. Observe in this context the intellectual precision of the Founding Fathers. They spoke of the right to the pursuit of happiness, not of the right to happiness. It means that a man has the right to take the actions he deems necessary to achieve his happiness. It does not mean that others must make him happy. The right to life means that a man has the right to support his life by his own work, on any economic level as high as his ability will carry him. It does not mean that others must provide him with the necessities of life. The right to property means that a man has the right to take the economic actions necessary to earn property, to use it and to dispose of it. It does not mean that others must provide him with property. The right of free speech means that a man has the right to express his ideas without danger of suppression, interference, or punitive action by the government. It does not mean that others must provide him with a lecture hall, a radio station, or a printing press through which to express his ideas. Any undertaking that involves more than one man requires the voluntary consent of every participant. Every one of them has the right to make his own decision, but none has the right to force his decision on the others. There's no such thing as a right to a job. There's only the right of free trade, that is, a man's right to take a job if another man chooses to hire him. There is no right to a home, only the right of free trade, the right to build a home or to buy it. There are no rights to a fair wage or a fair price if no one chooses to pay it, to hire a man or to buy his product. There are no rights of consumers to milk, shoes, movies, or champagne if no producers choose to manufacture such items. There is only the right to manufacture them oneself. There are no rights of special groups. There are no rights of farmers, of workers, of businessmen, of employees, of employers, of the old, of the young, of the unborn. There are only the rights of man, rights possessed by every individual man and by all men as individuals. Property rights and the right of free trade are man's only economic rights. They are, in fact, political rights, and there can be no such thing as an economic bill of rights. But observe that the advocates of the latter have all but destroyed the former. Remember that rights are moral principles which define and protect a man's freedom of action, but impose no obligations on other men. Private citizens are not a threat to one another's rights or freedom. A private citizen who resorts to physical force and violates the rights of others is a criminal, and men have legal protection against him. Criminals are a small minority in any age or country, and the harm they have done to mankind is infinitesimal when compared to the horrors, the bloodshed, the wars, the persecutions, the confiscations, the famines, the enslavements, the wholesale destructions perpetrated by man's governments. Potentially, a government is the most dangerous threat to man's rights. It holds a legal monopoly on the use of physical force against legally disarmed victims. When unlimited and unrestricted by individual rights, a government is man's deadliest enemy. It is not as protection against private actions, but against governmental actions that the Bill of Rights was written. Now observe the process by which that protection is being destroyed. The process consists of ascribing to private citizens the specific violations constitutionally forbidden to the government, which private citizens have no power to commit, and thus freeing the government from all restrictions. The switch is becoming progressively more obvious in the field of free speech. For years, the collectivists have been propagating the notion that a private individual's refusal to finance an opponent is a violation of the opponent's right of free speech and an act of censorship. It is censorship, they claim, If a newspaper refuses to employ or publish writers whose ideas are diametrically opposed to its policy, it is censorship, they claim. If businessmen refuse to advertise in a magazine that denounces, insults, and smears them, it is censorship, they claim. If a TV sponsor objects to some outrage perpetrated on a program he is financing, such as the incident of Alger Hiss being invited to denounce former Vice President Nixon. And then there is Newton N. Minow, who declares, there is censorship by ratings, by advertisers, by networks, by affiliates which reject programming offered to their areas. It is the same Mr. Minow who threatens to revoke the license of any station that does not comply with his views on programming, and who claims that that is not censorship. Consider the implications of such a trend. Censorship is a term pertaining only to governmental action. No private action is censorship. No private individual or agency can silence a man or suppress a publication. Only the government can do so. The freedom of speech of private individuals includes the right not to agree, not to listen, and not to finance one's own antagonists. But according to such doctrines as the Economic Bill of Rights, an individual has no right to dispose of his own material means by the guidance of his own convictions, and must hand over his money indiscriminately to any speakers or propagandists who have a right to his property. This means that the ability to provide the material tools for the expression of ideas deprives a man of the right to hold any ideas. It means that a publisher has to publish books he considers worthless, false, or evil. But a TV sponsor has to finance commentators who choose to affront his convictions. That the owner of a newspaper must turn his editorial pages over to any young hooligan who clamors for the enslavement of the press. It means that one group of men acquires the right to unlimited license, while another group is reduced to helpless irresponsibility. But since it is obviously impossible to provide every claimant with a job, a microphone, or a newspaper column, who will determine the distribution of economic rights and select the recipients when the owner's right to choose has been abolished? Well, Mr. Minow has indicated that quite clearly. And if you make the mistake of thinking that this applies only to big property owners, you had better realize that the theory of economic rights includes the right of every would-be playwright, every beatnik, poet, every noise composer, and every non-objective artist who have political pull to the financial support you did not give them when you did not attend their shows. What else is the meaning of the project to spend your tax money on subsidized art? And while people are clamoring about economic rights, the concept of political rights is vanishing. It is forgotten that the right of free speech means the freedom to advocate one's views and to bear the possible consequences, including disagreement with others, opposition, unpopularity, and lack of support. The political function of the right of free speech is to protect dissenters and unpopular minorities from forcible suppression, not to guarantee them the support, advantages, and rewards of a popularity they have not gained. The Bill of Rights reads, Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech or of the press. It does not demand that private citizens provide a microphone for the man who advocates their destruction, or a pass key for the burglar who seeks to rob them, or a knife for the murderer who wants to cut their throats. Such is the state of one of today's most crucial issues, political rights versus economic rights. It's either or. One destroys the other. But there are, in fact, no economic rights, no collective rights, no public interest rights. The term individual rights is a redundancy. There is no other kind of rights, and no one else to possess them. Those who advocate laissez-faire capitalism are the only advocates of man's rights. Appendix: The Nature of Government by Ayn Rand. A government is an institution that holds the exclusive power to enforce certain rules of social conduct in a given geographical area. Do men need such an institution, and why? Since man's mind is his basic tool of survival, his means of gaining knowledge to guide his actions, the basic condition he requires is the freedom to think and to act according to his rational judgment. This does not mean that a man must live alone and that a desert island is the environment best suited to his needs. Men can derive enormous benefits from dealing with one another. A social environment is most conducive to their successful survival, but only on certain conditions. The two great values to be gained from social existence are knowledge and trade. Man is the only species that can transmit and expand his store of knowledge from generation to generation. The knowledge potentially available to man is greater than any one man could begin to acquire in his own lifespan. Every man gains an incalculable benefit from the knowledge discovered by others. The second great benefit is the division of labor. It enables a man to devote his effort to a particular field of work and to trade with others who specialize in other fields. This form of cooperation allows all men who take part in it to achieve a greater knowledge, skill, and productive return on their effort than they could achieve if each had to produce everything he needs on a desert island or on a self-sustaining farm. But these very benefits indicate, delimit, and define what kind of men can be of value to one another and in what kind of society. Only rational, productive, independent men in a rational, productive, free society. The objectivist ethics in the virtue of selfishness. A society that robs an individual of the product of his effort, or enslaves him, or attempts to limit the freedom of his mind, or compels him to act against his own rational judgment. A society that sets up a conflict between its edicts and the requirements of man's nature is not, strictly speaking, a society, but a mob held together by institutionalized gang rule. Such a society destroys all the values of human coexistence, has no possible justification, and represents not a source of benefits, but the deadliest threat to man's survival. Life on a desert island is safer than and incomparably preferable to existence in Soviet Russia or Nazi Germany. If men are to live together in a peaceful, productive, rational society, and deal with one another to mutual benefit, they must accept the basic social principle without which no moral or civilized society is possible. The principle of individual rights. To recognize individual rights means to recognize and accept the conditions required by man's nature for his proper survival. Man's rights can be violated only by the use of physical force. It is only by means of physical force that one man can deprive another of his life, or enslave him, or rob him, or prevent him from pursuing his own goals, or compel him to act against his own rational judgment. The precondition of a civilized society is the barring of physical force from social relationships, thus establishing the principle that if men wish to deal with one another, they may do so only by means of reason, by discussion, persuasion, and voluntary uncoerced agreement. The necessary consequence of man's right to life is his right to self-defense. In a civilized society, force may be used only in retaliation, and only against those who initiate its use. All the reasons which make the initiation of physical force an evil make the retaliatory use of physical force a moral imperative. If some pacifist society renounced the retaliatory use of force, it would be left helplessly at the mercy of the first thug who decided to be immoral. Such a society would achieve the opposite of its intention. Instead of abolishing evil, it would encourage and reward it. If a society provided no organized protection against force, it would compel every citizen to go about armed, to turn his home into a fortress, to shoot any strangers approaching his door, or to join a protective gang of citizens who would fight other gangs, formed for the same purpose, and thus bring about the degeneration of that society into the chaos of gang rule, i.e. rule by brute force, into the perpetual tribe warfare of prehistorical savages. The use of physical force, even its retaliatory use, cannot be left at the discretion of individual citizens. Peaceful coexistence is impossible if a man has to live under the constant threat of force to be unleashed against him by any of his neighbors at any moment. Whether his neighbor's intentions are good or bad, whether their judgment is rational or irrational, whether they are motivated by a sense of justice or by ignorance, or by prejudice or by malice, The use of force against one man cannot be left to the arbitrary decision of another. Visualize, for example, what would happen if a man missed his wallet, concluded that he had been robbed, broke into every house in the neighborhood to search it, and shot the first man who gave him a dirty look, taking the look to be a proof of guilt. The retaliatory use of force requires objective rules of evidence to establish that a crime has been committed and to prove who committed it, as well as objective rules to define punishments and enforcement procedures. Men who attempt to prosecute crimes without such rules are a lynch mob. If a society left the retaliatory use of force in the hands of individual citizens, it would degenerate into mob rule, lynch law, and an endless series of bloody private feuds or vendettas. If physical force is to be barred from social relationships, men need an institution charged with the task of protecting their rights under an objective code of rules. This is the task of a government, of a proper government. Its basic task, its only moral justification, and the reason why men do need a government. A government is the means of placing the retaliatory use of physical force under objective control, i.e., under objectively defined laws. The fundamental difference between private action and governmental action, a difference thoroughly ignored and evaded today, lies in the fact that a government holds a monopoly on the legal use of physical force. It has to hold such a monopoly since it is the agent of restraining and combating the use of force. And for that very same reason, its actions have to be rigidly defined, delimited, and circumscribed. No touch of whim or caprice should be permitted in its performance. It should be an impersonal robot, with the laws as its only motive power. If a society is to be free, its government has to be controlled. Under a proper social system, a private individual is legally free to take any action he pleases, so long as he does not violate the rights of others, while a government official is bound by law in his every official act. A private individual may do anything except that which is legally forbidden. A government official may do nothing except that which is legally permitted. This is the means of subordinating might to right. This is the American concept of a government of laws and not of men. The nature of the laws proper to a free society and the source of its government's authority are both to be derived from the nature and purpose of a proper government. The basic principle of both is indicated in the Declaration of Independence. To secure these individual rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. Since the protection of individual rights is the only proper purpose of a government, it is the only proper subject of legislation. All laws must be passed on individual rights and aimed at their protection. All laws must be objective and objectively justifiable. Men must know clearly and in advance of taking an action what the law forbids them to do and why, what constitutes a crime and what penalty they will incur if they commit it. The source of the government's authority is the consent of the governed. This means that the government is not the ruler, but the servant or agent of the citizens. It means that the government as such has no rights except the rights delegated to it by the citizens for a specific purpose. There is only one basic principle to which an individual must consent if he wishes to live in a free, civilized society: the principle of renouncing the use of physical force and delegating to the government his right of physical self-defense for the purpose of an orderly, objective, legally defined enforcement. Or to put it another way, he must accept the separation of force and whim, any whim, including his own. Now what happens in a case of a disagreement between two men about an undertaking in which both are involved? In a free society, men are not forced to deal with one another. They do so only by voluntary agreement, and when a time element is involved, by contract. If a contract is broken by the arbitrary decision of one man, it may cause a disastrous financial injury to the other, and the victim would have no recourse except to seize the offender's property as compensation. But here again, the use of force cannot be left to the decision of private individuals, and this leads to one of the most important and most complex functions of the government, to the function of an arbiter who settles disputes among men according to objective laws. Criminals are in a small minority in any semi-civilized society, but the protection and enforcement of contracts through courts of civil law is the most crucial need of a peaceful society. Without such protection, no civilization could be developed or maintained. Man cannot survive as animals do, by acting on the range of the immediate moment. Man has to project his goals and achieve them across a span of time. He has to calculate his actions and plan his life long range. The better a man's mind and the greater his knowledge, the longer the range of his planning. The higher or more complex a civilization, the longer the range of activity it requires, and therefore the longer the range of contractual agreements among men, and the more urgent their need of protection for the security of such agreements. Even a primitive barter society could not function if a man agreed to trade a bushel of potatoes for a basket of eggs, and having received the eggs, refused to deliver the potatoes. Visualize what this sort of whim-directed action would mean in an industrial society, where men deliver $1 billion worth of goods on credit, or contract to build multi-million-dollar structures, or sign 99-year leases. A unilateral breach of contract involves an indirect use of physical force. It consists, in essence, of one man receiving the material values, goods, or services of another, then refusing to pay for them, and thus keeping them by force, by mere physical possession, not by right, i.e., keeping them without the consent of their owner. Fraud involves a similarly indirect use of force. It consists of obtaining material values without their owner's consent under false pretenses or false promises. Extortion is another variant of an indirect use of force. It consists of obtaining material values not in exchange for values, but by the threat of force, violence, or injury. Some of these actions are obviously criminal. Others, such as a unilateral breach of contract, may not be criminally motivated, but may be caused by irresponsibility and irrationality. Still others may be complex issues with some claim to justice on both sides. But whatever the case may be, all such issues have to be made subject to objectively defined laws and have to be resolved by an impartial arbiter administering the laws, i.e., by a judge and a jury when appropriate. Observe the basic principle governing justice in all these cases. It is the principle that no man may obtain any values from others without the owner's consent. And, as a corollary, that a man's rights may not be left at the mercy of the unilateral decision, the arbitrary choice, the irrationality, the whim of another man. Such, in essence, is the proper purpose of a government, to make social existence possible to men by protecting the benefits and combating the evils which men can cause to one another. The proper functions of a government fall into three broad categories, all of them involving the issues of physical force and the protection of men's rights: the police, to protect men from criminals; the armed services, to protect men from foreign invaders; the law courts, to settle disputes among men according to objective laws. These three categories involve many corollary and derivative issues, and their implementation in practice in the form of specific legislation is enormously complex. It belongs to the field of a special science, the philosophy of law. Many errors and many disagreements are possible in the field of implementation, but what is essential here is the principle to be implemented, the principle that the purpose of law and of government is the protection of individual rights. Today this principle is forgotten, ignored, and evaded. The result is the present state of the world, with mankind's retrogression to the lawlessness of absolutist tyranny, to the primitive savagery of rule by brute force. In unthinking protest against this trend, some people are raising the question of whether government as such is evil by nature, and whether anarchy is the ideal social system. Anarchy as a political concept is a naive, floating abstraction. For all the reasons discussed above, a society without an organized government would be at the mercy of the first criminal who came along, and who would precipitate it into the chaos of gang warfare. But the possibility of human immorality is not the only objection to anarchy. Even a society whose every member were fully rational and faultlessly moral could not function in a state of anarchy. It is the need of objective laws and of an arbiter for honest disagreements among men that necessitates the establishment of a government. A recent variant of anarchistic theory, which is befuddling some of the younger advocates of freedom, is a weird absurdity called competing governments. Accepting the basic premise of the modern statists, who see no difference between the functions of government and the functions of industry, between force and production, and who advocate government ownership of business, the proponents of competing governments take the other side of the same coin and declare that since competition is so beneficial to business, it should also be applied to government. Instead of a single monopolistic government, they declare, there should be a number of different governments in the same geographical area competing for the allegiance of individual citizens, with every citizen free to shop and to patronize whatever government he chooses. Remember that forcible restraint of men is the only service a government has to offer. Ask yourself what a competition in forcible restraint would have to mean. One cannot call this theory a contradiction in terms, since it is obviously devoid of any understanding of the terms competition and government. Nor can one call it a floating abstraction, since it is devoid of any contact with or reference to reality and cannot be concretized at all, not even roughly or approximately. One illustration will be sufficient. Suppose Mr. Smith, a customer of Government A, suspects that his next-door neighbor Mr. Jones, a customer of Government B, has robbed him. A squad of Police A proceeds to Mr. Jones's house and is met at the door by a squad of Police B, who declare that they do not accept the validity of Mr. Smith's complaint and do not recognize the authority of Government A. What happens then? You take it from there. The evolution of the concept of government has had a long, tortuous history. Some glimmer of the government's proper function seems to have existed in every organized society, manifesting itself in such phenomena as the recognition of some implicit, if often non-existent, difference between a government and a robber gang, the aura of respect and of moral authority granted to the government as the guardian of law and order, the fact that even the most evil types of government found it necessary to maintain some semblance of order and some pretense at justice, if only by routine and tradition, and to claim some sort of moral justification for their power of a mystical or social nature. Just as the absolute monarchs of France had to invoke the divine right of kings, so the modern dictators of Soviet Russia have to spend fortunes on propaganda to justify their rule in the eyes of their enslaved subjects. In mankind's history, the understanding of the government's proper function is a very recent achievement. It is only 200 years old, and it dates from the founding fathers of the American Revolution. Not only did they identify the nature and the needs of a free society, but they devised the means to translate it into practice. A free society, like any other human product, cannot be achieved by random means, by mere wishing, or by the leader's good intentions. A complex legal system based on objectively valid principles is required to make a society free and to keep it free. A system that does not depend on the motives, the moral character, or the intentions of any given official. A system that leaves no opportunity, no legal loophole for the development of tyranny. The American system of checks and balances was just such an achievement. And although certain contradictions in the Constitution did leave a loophole for the growth of statism, the incomparable achievement was the concept of a constitution as a means of limiting and restricting the power of the government. Today, when a concerted effort is made to obliterate this point, it cannot be repeated too often that the Constitution is a limitation on the government, not on private individuals, that it does not prescribe the conduct of private individuals, only the conduct of the government, that it is not a charter for government power, but a charter of the citizens' protection against the government. Now consider the extent of the moral and political inversion in today's prevalent view of government. Instead of being a protector of man's rights, the government is becoming their most dangerous violator. Instead of guarding freedom, the government is establishing slavery. Instead of protecting men from the initiators of physical force, the government is initiating physical force and coercion in any manner and issue it pleases. instead of serving as the instrument of objectivity in human relationships. The government is creating a deadly subterranean reign of uncertainty and fear by means of non-objective laws whose interpretation is left to the arbitrary decisions of random bureaucrats. Instead of protecting men from injury by whim, the government is arrogating to itself the power of unlimited whim, so that we are fast approaching the stage of the ultimate inversion, the stage where the government is free to do anything it pleases, while the citizens may act only by permission, which is the stage of the darkest periods of human history, the stage of rule by brute force. It has often been remarked that in spite of its material progress, mankind has not achieved any comparable degree of moral progress. That remark is usually followed by some pessimistic conclusion about human nature. It is true that the moral state of mankind is disgracefully low. But if one considers the monstrous moral inversions of the governments, made possible by the altruist collectivist morality, under which mankind has had to live through most of its history, one begins to wonder how men have managed to preserve even a semblance of civilization, and what indestructible vestige of self-esteem has kept them walking upright on 2 feet. One also begins to see more clearly the nature of the political principles that have to be accepted and advocated as part of the battle for man's intellectual renaissance. This concludes the reading of Capitalism, the Unknown Ideal by Ayn Rand. This book was read by Anna Fields. Blackstone patrons who enjoy this unabridged work also enjoy Blackstone titles by Ayn Rand, Anthem, Atlas Shrugged, The Fountainhead, and We the Living. If you would like to obtain a complete catalog of our titles, or our monthly update telling you about new releases and our new collection of books on CD, write Blackstone Audiobooks, P.O. Box 969, Ashland, Oregon, ZIP 97520, or call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. You may also obtain the same information from our award-winning website. Our address, all one word, is www.blackstoneaudio.com. Thank you.